In 2002, Dr. Daniel Baxter left his job at a New York City hospital to treat AIDS patients in Botswana. 16 years ago, nearly one in four people in Botswana were reportedly HIV positive. And a lot of people didn't know they were infected and were afraid to get tested. During Dr. Baxter's 8 years there, he treated countless patients, including a man who exercised at the same gym as him, a pregnant woman who worked for him, and children whose parents saw them as burdens. His patients' dire situations made him question a lot about his own life, life in the USA, and the nature of suffering. He grappled with a question that many of us do. Is there a hierarchy to suffering? What he discovered is empowering. Dr. Daniel Baxter's memoir, One Life at a Time, is published by Skyhorse. He's here with us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you write that you watched that man at the gym wither away in front of you in Botswana. What do we know about him?
Well, I knew very little about him, except he was very rude in the gym. He wouldn't wipe off the machines. He hogged the machines and all of that. And I saw after about a year that he was starting his downward descent. He was losing weight. He was looking gaunter. And when he almost got himself injured in the gym because of his weakness, I, in my typical doctor's voice, gruffly called out, you know, here's my card, give me a call if I can help. And he took me up on the offer, and eventually he survived.
He survived?
Yes. He got on HIV treatment. And as I closed the story, I saw that he was running for parliament from the opposition party. And I didn't really check to see whether or not he won, because he had conquered a far more formidable foe, HIV.
Was he less rude to you?
No. He continued to hog the machines. And that's fine.
So how did you begin working with AIDS patients here in New York City?
Well, I was in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I had seen the pandemic unfold. And I was always interested in HIV, not so much because of the medicine. I mean, that was interesting, but it was because of the ethical and philosophical issues. Because back then, even more so than now, there was a lot of stigma, guilt, and shame associated with it. And I just reacted with horror to how HIV-infected people were treated like lepers.
So what were your patients like?
I worked at the Spelman Center at St. Clair's, which is no more, and that was back in the early 90s when they heralded the so-called new face of AIDS, namely intravenous drug users, minorities, people of color, women. And those patients back then were very difficult, but that was a time when we had no effective treatments.
So how did you decide to pack up your life in New York City and moved to Botswana?
Well, I had always wanted to work in a developing country, and I felt that the HIV scene here in the States, by and large, was under control. And I just felt a natural inclination to do that.
How did your peers react to your decision to just leave?
Well, you know, at the time, everyone gushed, oh, how wonderful, and all of that. And in retrospect, I realized that I went there very much unaware about myself and about life. I thought I knew all the answers and had learned them on my AIDS ward at St. Clair's. But as I soon found out after I got there, I knew nothing. I didn't even know the questions to ask, let alone the answers.
What was the major question that you just didn't know to ask?
How HIV affects each and every individual, and how in Botswana, HIV was viewed really as a mysterious illness. I went there thinking that I was going to save people. Ultimately, I realized that the only person I can ever save, if I'm lucky, is myself. And as a physician, all I really can do is give my patients precious extra time for them to save themselves.
When we talk about that guy at the gym, he actually ran for parliament because of the time that you helped him get.
Yeah. And as I said, you never know what an intervention will do.
So what kind of conditions were you working in when you arrived at that hospital in Botswana?
Well, the Princess Marina Hospital was the main referral hospital, and it had problems with resources. It was very clean. It was always very clean. But There weren't as many medications. Getting something like a chest x-ray was often a major hurdle. And it was far, far different from any hospital I've worked at in the United States.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Dr. Daniel Baxter about his memoir, One Life at a Time, an American Doctor's Memoir of AIDS in Botswana. So Dr. Baxter, you mentioned these medications. Were they receiving different medications or just not enough?
Okay. In terms of HIV treatment, the first line therapy when I first arrived in late 2002 was the same as first line therapy here. And in terms of treatment, other antibiotics and such, it was a combination of certain drugs not being available, running out of medications. At the hospital, they would order supplies when they ran out. And so since it took many months for many of the supplies to come in, it was not at all uncommon for important medications simply not to be available.
And when they're not available, that costs time and could lead to deaths.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Did you have a tough time adjusting to the culture?
Not really. The Botswana are very kind and forgiving people, and really, if it wasn't for their kindness, I don't think that I could have lasted there. I mean, it's a different country. On my driver's license application in 2003, one of the questions was, are you or have you ever been an imbecile? Now, that's an existential mind twister. But the Botswana lived in the moment. But they had a deep spirituality. So many times a patient would tell me her unfathomable woes, but would always end it with, but God is good.
Were there superstitions surrounding the disease?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. People thought that it was a curse put on them by a witch doctor. Especially among the poor people in the rural areas, HIV was regarded as a mysterious illness. That AIDS was regarded as part of nature, and nature was regarded as something that they couldn't confront. They just had to work around it. But with the new HIV medications, as I would like to say, every time the medicines were being prescribed in the clinics in Botswana, the old gods and the old traditions were crumbling.
So how did you navigate around these old gods and old traditions, given the fact that people need medicine?
Well, you know, the nurses were so crucial in that regard. They acted as more than just translators. They were able to actually, many of the times, the nurses knew everything about the patient. They knew where they lived. And the nurses were very good explaining concepts of infection and treatment. Setswana, the language in Botswana, it's very nuanced. And the metaphors are very, very rich. I did not learn Setswana. There are no cognates like Italian or Spanish. And the nurses, by and large, were very, very crucial in helping me address the individual cultural issues that patients would face.
When someone is ill, it's often said that the whole family is suffering. How did families interact with your patients?
Oh, I mean, HIV AIDS was a family affair in Botswana because many members of the family would be simultaneously infected. Families would come to the hospital during visiting hours to give them food, to help wash them, give them clean bedding. There was a far greater sense of community among the family and patients than exists here in the United States. The family was the only social net a patient had.
Were there any negative realities that families faced with their sick relatives?
The only negative reality that immediately comes to mind is if a patient would be brought in comatose and they were HIV positive, we would want to do a spinal tap on them. And families had this idea that spinal taps killed patients. And that there was a struggle there. But by and large, the family was supportive. I might add that patients starting treatment were encouraged to have an adherence partner to make sure that the patient took their medicines. And if a patient was demented from HIV, the chances that he or she could take their medicines regularly were very small. And so a devoted family member was their only salvation.
Did anyone just refuse to believe they were infected?
Oh, all of the time. Early on, many patients in the hospital would refuse to be tested. They would rather go to their graves than be HIV tested because of the stigma and shame associated with it.
Does that stigma and shame lead to some families abandoning their loved ones or not supporting them as much?
Well, I told the story about one of my first great failures, a 10-year-old girl dying from AIDS. And the family decided that she was too much of a burden. And so they didn't abandon her so much. They just took her to her home village and she died there. So
Did they take care of her there or did they just leave her there?
They put her in a room, most likely, and they didn't feed her. And
wait a minute. You're saying that they took her home. They knew that she had AIDS.
Yes.
They put her in a room and they starved her.
Well, they didn't feed her, let's put it that way. And, you know, this happens because many times girls were regarded as a burden. That's changed over time now that the effectiveness of the HIV medicines is obvious to almost anyone in Botswana.
So how did you find the right way to help when you were surrounded by so much need?
Well, I eventually realized that, at the risk of being cliched, it was one life at a time. The CDC, UNAIDS, World Health Organization, they were very, very important in fighting HIV in sub-Saharan Africa. But as an individual doctor, I realized that it was each individual patient that was the only way to approach it without going crazy.
There's this notion that doctors turn off their feelings. And I have a couple of relatives who are physicians, and they often tell me that they feel things emotionally. Could you afford to be connected with these patients?
Well, there's a fine line, as I tell medical students and residents, between caring too much and caring too little. And you know, you need to reach that state in your career, state of grace, where you feel as if you're taking away more from your patients in terms of lessons about life and yourself. So, yeah, I have little patience with doctors that do not show some empathy and feeling to patients that are suffering.
So from those experiences, what have you learned that you're applying in the USA?
Okay. I went to Botswana with the arrogant feeling that American patients were spoiled, demanding, and entitled. I had nothing but withering contempt for them.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was my downfall. And ultimately, again, it sounds trite, but I realized that no one's suffering is greater than anyone else's. And it was my last year there at Marina Hospital where my team and I were taking care of Dolly, a 20-year-old woman. She was comatose. She was on her way out. She had been raped by her pastor at age 13 and obviously had had a terrible life. And that was the tipping point where I realized, it was an epiphany, that no one's suffering is greater than anyone else's. And that really is what allowed me to come back to the United States almost 3 years ago and treat these, and I put this in quote, demanding, entitled American patients, and enjoying it. And I think the love has been returned by and large in my practice at the Ryan Center.
What you say sort of sticks with me. No one's suffering is greater than anyone else's, even though we often hear people saying, do this or that because there are people in Africa specifically who live in this situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But your experience says, you know, people are people.
Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Daniel Baxter. It's really extraordinary work that you're doing.
Thank you for your interest.
And I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I've been speaking with Dr. Daniel Baxter about his memoir, One Life at a Time, an American doctor's memoir of AIDS in Botswana.